Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome again Professor Mittal, who's giving... it's the third one now, the third... we've got one more to go, haven't we, I think, yes. Sharing his research with us. And today he's going to speak on Gandhi, and particularly on Satyagraha, in a lecture entitled Gandhian Techniques of Conflict Resolution. So, Professor Mittal, over to you.
Thank you, Professor. Luck. Let me begin my presentation by narrating a conversation I had with a friend in the first quarter of 2005, who was worried that nonviolence is unrealistic. And I said to this friend that we are developing a Center for Global Nonviolence at James Madison University in Virginia, US. He was astonished and immediately replied, "Our nation is struck in wars that stretch from the Middle East into Central Asia. In fact, our president has declared a worldwide war on terror. Could there be a worse time to create a center for global nonviolence?" After a brief moment of silence, my response was, "Yes, a worse time would be when everyone is lulled to sleep by a short-lived period of peace. In fact, right now is the best time to encourage people to consider alternative ways to think and to take action. Everyone is awake to the fact that our fellow citizens, soldiers, and many other innocent people die every day due to violent conflicts that show no signs of letting up or coming to a happy ending. This is exactly the kind of situation that calls for us to bring our best resources together to discover more effective ways to respond to difficult contemporary challenges." "But isn't nonviolence," he persisted, "merely a way to duck and run instead of confronting world problems head on?" I had to respond with an emphatic no to this question, because he was confusing a commitment to nonviolence with a preference for inactivity or a passive attitude of someone who would prefer not to be involved. Nonviolence is a positive, active method of response instead of refusal to act in the face of troubling or even seemingly impossible situations where the odds are going against you. "But isn't nonviolence actually an unrealistic method?" He was still unconvinced. "It may be what," he continued, "it may be something nice to think about, but has it really accomplished anything worthwhile?" Since my friend is a sensitive and intelligent person, one might be inclined to agree with him. However, if we look into the history of nonviolent action and what it has achieved, one would be positively surprised. Nonviolence as a strategy for change repeatedly has proven to be dangerously effective rather than too idealistic, harmless, or simply useless. It can have particular unpleasant effects on oppressive traditions and entrenched interests that seem unaware that they are resting on unjust and unequal structures. Nashville, Tennessee, in the U.S., learned that lesson in 1960 when James Lawson organized the first peaceful sit-in at racially segregated lunch counters in downtown stores. Despite resistance by merchants, complicity by the local government, lack of protection by police, and efforts to provoke the well-disciplined demonstrators to respond directly to harassment, the campaign succeeded and contributed to a positive transformation in the city. It took Nashville a few years to absorb and consolidate the changes set in motion by James Lawson. James Lawson's nonviolent leadership. And it took the city's premier university even longer. Vanderbilt University expelled Lawson, who was a theological student at that time, and fired the Divinity School's energetic young dean because he publicly protested Lawson's expulsion. The fired Robert Nelson lost his job, but went on to a distinguished career elsewhere. And the Reverend James Lawson finally received long-delayed recognition when he was named Vanderbilt's Alumnus of the Year in 2005. Nonviolence is effective, but requires training and discipline in order to work, and can be costly to participants. So what inspired Lawson? The key event was meeting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1956 at Oberlin College in Ohio. But it is doubtful that their meeting would have had so dramatic an outcome had it not been that both of them were already deeply influenced by the example of Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi before they met. Lawson had served as a Methodist missionary in India and had direct knowledge of Gandhi's work there and in South Africa. Dr. King had studied with Howard Thurman at Boston University, and Thurman, who was the grandson of North Florida slaves, had a long-time appreciation for Gandhi's nonviolent methods. King advised that Lawson should contribute to change in the American South, and so he transferred from Oberlin to Vanderbilt. And this story of the formation of a movement for racial justice in Nashville, if you would be interested, is retold at length by David Halberstam in his excellent book called The Children, published in 1998. Gandhi, a man who bridged two centuries and two continents, is widely acknowledged as one of the makers of the 20th century, and a much needed counterexample to the unprecedented brutality of that century as well. He was a pioneer in the leadership of both local and national campaigns of nonviolent resistance. Born in 1869, educated in India and England, Gandhi went to Africa in 1893 and worked there at intervals until returning to India during the First World War. In the interwar period, he led two major nonviolent protests against colonialism from 1990 to 1922, and again in 1930 and 31. He called a halt to the first one when it became clear to him that participants were not sufficiently prepared to resist the temptations of violence. The second one was more successful and included his famous march to the sea. The great tragedy came in his life at the end of the colonial era in 1947-48. After the Second World War, the British government, nearly bankrupt because of the war, rashly divided India into two nations that were separated by Muslim and Hindu religious differences, and then quickly departed, leaving their former colonial subjects to suffer the consequences. An elderly and frail Gandhi traveled the country to counsel nonviolence and encourage peace. On January 30th, 1948, as he was walking to a prayer meeting, Gandhi was shot dead by a man who had been motivated by violent religious hatred. Gandhi gave up his life for his nonviolent principles. It was in the open air, in the midst of the crowd of ordinary people, that Gandhi delivered his genial message of nonviolence. That was his laboratory. It was lived. It was a concrete part of history. It became fused with culture. It penetrated folk custom. It appealed to the learned. Gandhi, however, did not invent or reinvent nonviolence. But he did invent a new concept, Satyagraha. Following extensive analysis and carefully fashioned experiments in which he was personally engaged. Gandhi first spoke explicitly of Satyagraha in South Africa in 1908. He coined the word by joining two Sanskrit terms, Satya, truth, and Agraha, holding firmly. Satyagraha, Gandhi explained, is, and I quote, literally holding on to truth, and it means therefore truth force. Truth implies love and firmness engenders and therefore serves as a synonym for force. That is to say, the force is the force which is born of truth and love or nonviolence. Satyagraha is characterized by adherence to a stated truth by means of behavior which is nonviolent, but which includes self-suffering. What is so distinct about Satyagraha is the self-suffering of the individuals participating in non-violent campaigns. Self-suffering is elevated to a completely different level of conceptualization by linking it with truth, which is not merely a value, but a force inspiring the Satyagrahi or practitioner of Satyagraha to make even the supreme sacrifice. As Gandhi argued, and I am again quoting him, with the conviction that truth is not to be renounced even unto death, they shed the fear of death. In the cause of truth, the prison was a palace to them, and its doors the gateway to freedom. End of quotation. Satyagraha is therefore not identical with passive resistance. When identifying the features of Satyagraha, Gandhi was of the opinion that passive resistance, and again I'm quoting him, that passive resistance fails to convey what he meant. It describes a method but gives no hint of the system of which it is only a part. Real beauty, and that is my aim, Gandhi says, is in doing against evil. In other words, the similarity between Satyagraha and passive resistance is just peripheral, since both of them are clearly defined methods of resistance, opposed to violence. Gandhi may certainly have drawn on passive resistance conceptually, but when he defined Satyagraha, he underlined its unique nature and characteristics. As he elaborated, this is a long quote. Passive resistance, he says, is a method of securing rights by personal suffering. It is the reverse of resistance by arms. When I refuse to do a thing that is repulsive to my conscience, I use soul force. For instance, the government of the day has passed a law which is applicable to me. I do not like it. If by using I force the government to repeal the law, I am employing what may be termed body force. If I do not obey the law and accept the penalty for its breach, I use soul force. It involves sacrifice of self. End of quotation. Passive resistance can therefore never be equated with Satyagraha for the simple reason, as Gandhi himself stated, that it involved application of force as well. While in Satyagraha, the application of force of whatever variety is completely ruled out. Hence, he was most categorical by saying that, again I quote him, that passive resistance is an all-sided sword. It can be used anyhow. It blesses him who uses it, and him against whom it is used. Without drawing a drop of blood, it produces what it produced, far-reaching results. It never rusts and cannot be stolen. Competition between passive resistors does not exhaust. The sword of passive resistance does not require scabbard. It is strange indeed that you should consider such a weapon to be the weapon merely of the weak. End of quotation. Satyagraha is not physical force, but soul force. Soul force that draws on the spontaneous sacrifice of self by the participants. I think this is an important point. Let me repeat. Soul force that draws on the spontaneous sacrifice of self by the participants. Gandhi associated passive resistance with internal violence. It harbored hostility and anger among resistors, even when they commit no physical violence. It unleashed forces of prejudice and separatism rather than compassion and inclusiveness. And while emphasizing this dimension, Gandhi further argued, again a quotation, long one from him, "Everybody admits that sacrifice of self is infinitely superior to sacrifice of others. Moreover, if this kind of force is used in a course that is unjust, only the person using it suffers. He does not make others suffer for his mistakes. Men have before now done many things which were subsequently found to have been wrong. No man can claim to be absolutely in the right, or that a particular thing is wrong, because he thinks so. But it is wrong for him so long as that is his deliberate judgment. It is therefore meant that he should not do that which he knows to be wrong, and suffer the consequences, whatever it may be. This is the key to use soul force." End of quotation. Satyagraha is not used against anybody. Satyagraha is not used against anybody, but is done with somebody. A satyagrahi, or practitioner of satyagraha, Gandhi states, does not inflict pain on the adversary. He does not seek his destruction. In the use of satyagraha, there is no ill will at all. No aftermath of resentment. No bitterness, no revenge, no punishment. The insistence on truth, he states, arms the votary with matchless power, power that constitutes the core of satyagraha. The only force of universal application can be, as he says, that of love or nonviolence, which, as I mentioned earlier, Gandhi defined as soul force. He states, "Love never claims, it ever gives. Love ever suffers, never resents, never revenges itself. The test of love is tapasya, and tapasya expresses penance, mortification, expiation, and self-suffering." End of quotation. Love, Gandhi contends, alters both attitudes and behaviors over the long term. It alters both attitudes and behaviors over the long term. It can cause people to act in ways that transcend self-interest. Love appeals to what is best in persons. It can melt hatred and anger. It seeks to defeat resentment and open new ways of thinking how we can live harmoniously with the other. Gandhi believed that unless someone is prepared to suffer at the hands of the violent, then there is no way of bringing about a feeling of penance and mortification from the violent oppressor. Suffering without retaliation brings about the transformation of those committed to violence. Suffering injury in one's person, he says, is of the essence of non-violence and is the chosen substitute for violence to others. Self-suffering for truth is not a weapon of the weak, but a powerful device based on a higher form of courage and fearlessness than that resorting to violence. Let me repeat this. Self-suffering for truth is not a weapon of the weak, but a powerful device based on a higher form of courage and fearlessness than that resorting to violence. I'll talk more about this in our question and answer period, this concept of fearlessness. And it is also an aid in the moral persuasion of one's opponents. The basic principles of a Satyagraha campaign can be systematized in 10 points. 1. Violence is invited from opponents if they are humiliated or provoked. If they are humiliated or provoked. 2. A violent attitude is less likely on the part of a would-be Satyagrahi or practitioner of Satyagraha if they have made clear to themselves the essential elements of their case and the purpose of their struggle. 3. Opponents are less likely to use violent means the better they understand the Satyagrahi's case and conduct. 4. The essential interests that the opponents have in common should be clearly formulated and cooperation established on that basis. 5. Opponents should not be judged harder than the self. In other words, there must be mutual toleration. 6. Opponents should be trusted. 7. An unwillingness to compromise on non-essentials decreases the likelihood of converting the opponent. 8. The conversion of an opponent is furthered by personal sincerity. Personal sincerity. So how do you show personal sincerity? How does the other see your personal sincerity? How? Again, we'll discuss this later. Keep these in mind. 9. The best way of convincing an opponent of the sincerity of the Satyagrahi is to make sacrifices for the given cause. 10. Position of weakness in an opponent should not be exploited. Indeed, Gandhi specified codes that followers were expected to adhere to. For example, 1. Harbor no anger, but suffer the anger of the opponent. Harbor no anger, but suffer the anger of the opponent. Refuse to return the assaults of the opponent. 2. Do not submit to any order given in anger, even though severe punishment is threatened for disobeying. 3. Refrain from insults and swearing. 4. Protect opponents from insults or attack, even at the risk of life. 5. do not resist arrest, nor the attachment of property, unless holding property as a trustee. 6. Refuse to surrender any property held in trust at the risk of life. 7. Gandhi says, if taken prisoner, behave in an exemplary manner. Of course, prisoner has to be contextualized for our times, for our context. 8. As a member of the Satyagraha unit, obey the orders of Satyagraha leaders and resign from the unit in the event of serious disagreement. And if these prerequisites are fulfilled, the scene is set for the process aimed at the required conversion to be initiated. Satyagraha is to be preceded by a careful study of the situation, the patient gathering of facts, followed by a clear and public statement of objectives. So to allow time for the opposing party to negotiate. Negotiate through discussion and reason, and then reach a mutually agreed settlement. Only when this fails, meaning negotiation through discussion and reason, one evolves to persuasion through suffering or suffering love. For example, fasting. The last straw to appeal to the heart of the opponents. Wherein the Satyagrahi or the proponent of Satyagraha attempts to dramatize the issues at stake. There's a lot of drama in all this, human drama. And all of it is unpredictable. Wherein the Satyagrahi or the proponent of Satyagraha attempts to dramatize the issues at stake and to get through to the opponent's rational judgment so that he may willingly come again onto a level where he may be persuaded through natural argument. End of quotation. As the opponent's heart is reached through suffering love, there opens the possibility of seeing the world in a different way. Once this happens, this is again a very important step. To see the world in a different way, as your opponent does. Thus far, whatever I have said, it's all practical. But to see the world in a different way, as your opponent does. Once this happens, they are ready to hear rational appeals and conversion, or moral conversion, is possible. Even with someone like Bin Laden, I'm using it as a symbol. But first step is to see the world in his as he sees it. He has been trying to destroy my ethnicity as a Hindu for ages. For ages. But I try to see the world in his way. And then I can see why he's angry. Not that I like it. He has killed millions of Hindus over the centuries. These are facts. But when you see it from his perspective, and when you listen to his speeches, you say, yeah, you become sympathetic to him. Even, but you know, as a Hindu, not, I don't mean as an academic, as a Hindu, I can say, yeah, he has a point. And then I go back in my, you know, small world, and I say, no, completely disagree with him, that bastard. You know, then I come to my senses or nonsenses, because all these are emotional. It's like I said, it's human drama, and that too unpredictable human drama. As Gandhi argued, again a quotation, suffering, he says, is the law of human beings. War is the law of the jungle. But suffering is infinitely more powerful than the law of the jungle for converting the opponent and opening his ears, which are otherwise shut, to the voice of reason. Nobody has probably drawn up more petitions, Gandhi continues, or espoused more forlorn causes than I. And I have come to the fundamental conclusion that if you want something really important to be done, you must not merely satisfy the reason. You must move the heart also. You need to get to the heart. And the appeal of reason is more to the head, but penetration of heart comes from suffering. It's practical. Why would someone suffer for the other if they were not really sincere in their drama, as I call it? Oh, Gandhi continues. So the appeal of reason is more to the head, but penetration of heart comes from suffering. It opens up the inner understanding of man. Suffering is the badge of the human race, not the sword. End of quotation. However, if persuasion by reasoning or suffering still fails, then the practitioner of Satyagraha may resort to non-violent coercion, coercing the other through non-violent means, characterized by such techniques as non-cooperation or civil disobedience. What is non-cooperation? Non-cooperation is the refusal to cooperate with a requirement which is taken to violate fundamental truths and may include strike, walkout, economic boycott, and resignation of offices and titles. Civil disobedience is the breaking of specific laws and may include such activities as non-payment of taxes and going to jail. There is a risk here. There is a risk here, however. The risk is that non-violence may give way to violence, or that the two parties may become so estranged that any agreement to come together will prove difficult to maintain in the long run. In a compelling figure of speech, Gandhi described the delicacy of this process. He says, the rope dancer, balancing himself upon a rope suspended at a height of 20 feet, must concentrate his attention upon the rope, and the least error means death for him. A satyagrahi or practitioner of satyagraha has to be, if possible, even more single-minded. End of quotation. Because we are dealing with human relations, emotions, raw emotions, unpredictable emotions. So one has to be, as Gandhi says, more single-minded even then the rope dancer. In the Satyagraha process, a moral choice is demanded of the opponents, which they otherwise may not even have contemplated. A moral choice is demanded of opponents. While forcing the Satyagrahis to understand, to examine their own motives for being involved in a Satyagraha, and moreover, their obligations to others involved in the encounter. It's not just your motives, but you also have obligations to others involved in the encounter. Gandhi continues, he says, Gandhi underscores the need to be, in fact, sensitive. You need to be sensitive to one's opponent's needs and even to help them when they lose their freedom to be autonomous counter players. Be sensitive to one's opponent's needs. In my case, it would be like saying be sensitive to Bin Laden's needs. At a practical level. Above all, he stated that objective evil must never be equated with the persona of the individual, as we do in the West. In the Western tradition. Finally, Gandhi noted the limitations of Satyagraha. It cannot be adopted in every situation because some situations lack the moral clarity. And it's usually not your opponent, as we like to think. Huh? Some lack the disciplined actors or followers. And all too many lack an opponent with a sense of fair play. Satyagraha, Gandhi noted wistfully, does not work with tyrants. It does not work with tyrants. Let me come back to my earlier and then conclude my earlier. I started with Howard Thurman, James Lawson. Let me come back to them and then I'll conclude. Satyagraha and its workings and limitations were well known to Howard Thurman, James Lawson, and Martin Luther King. They were under no illusions about the potential difficulties in a life dedicated to non-violent action. They were realists who knew that vigilance is the price of liberty. They were realists who knew that vigilance is the price of liberty. And that willingness to work and suffer is the price of justice. In 1963, when King gave his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., many of his most dedicated fellow activists were wearing Gandhi caps. People think it's these are Muslim caps. Muslim, what's his name? I forget.
Malcolm X.
Thank you. But these are Gandhi caps. People do not know. So in 1963, when King gave his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial, many of his most dedicated fellow activists were wearing Gandhi caps that symbolized their direct connection to the non-violent principles of the man who had been called the Mahatma, or Great Soul of India. Gandhi's principles of Satyagraha have been carried forward in non-violent protests and indeed revolutions in many parts of the world. It would be impossible to list the many successes in this presentation, but mention has to be made of the movement that began with Lech Walesa in the shipyards of Poland and ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall, as well as the independence and reconciliation movements in South Africa that were inspired by the late President Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Among movements that currently are active, probably the best known is the work of the Dalai Lama for achieving resolution of unresolved issues with China about the status of Tibet. So let me conclude and then we'll discuss. Yeah. Gandhian nonviolence would seem to hold out a great hope for the future of humanity. Everyone can practice it. Everyone can respond to it. And it can be applied in all the spheres of life, social, religious, political, economic. However, it must be tailored carefully to one's immediate context. Satyagraha is more than a strategy for peaceful change. It is a program for the transformation of relationships. It aims to change the attitudes of the opponent by mobilizing the power of love so that they may change their outlooks and behaviors. It seeks to defeat resentment and open new ways of thinking how we can live harmoniously with the other. It consists in total avoidance of harm to another in thought, in speech, in action. It is neither a doctrine nor a dogma. It is an action, an act of every moment. It is more of an existential happening than natural breathing. It is about struggle. It is an active, life-affirming, positive force. A force which transcends individuals, cultures, religions. It leads to the welfare of all. Satyagraha, in other words, represents a philosophy in practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mittal. So we have a